Allow me, if I might, to channel basically the entire global economy today. Markets, companies, and countries alike reacting to this news.
It'll be 25% for steel. It'll be 10% for aluminum.
What in the Sam Hill is going on around here? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the first day of March. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. In retrospect, of course, we should have seen this coming. The tariffs that the White House pre-announced today, and we'll explain that word pre-announced in just a bit. But come back with me first, would you, to Monday night, my interview with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and his response to my question about the possibility of these very tariffs.
The United States has the lowest tariffs, has the lowest barriers. Every single country wants to do business in the United States. And, by the way, to the extent that we can do business with other countries on the exact same terms, okay, and our companies can be treated the exact same way, we believe in reciprocal free trade.
That was then, this is now. Today, the president's saying in a room full of aluminum and steel executives basically the same thing, just more in his way.
They won't be dumping on our country. What they do is they dump massive amounts of product in our country, and it just kills, it destroys our companies and our jobs, and that's been happening for so many years, and we are not the beneficiary.
Tariffs are a complicated macroeconomic topic anytime, made more so when they catch everybody unawares. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson covers global trade for us. Hey, Tracy.
Hey, Kai.
So help me understand the mechanics of this announcement, how it all came down, huh?
Yeah, so this was a big day for nerdy trade people like me, and it was...
You're not nerdy. Come on.
Oh, come on. Just a little bit. And we got some extra drama because this announcement sort of seemed like it was going to happen when we learned about this meeting with the aluminum and steel executives. Mm-hmm. Then it seemed like it wasn't going to happen. Maybe it was just a listening session until, wait a sec, oops, there you go. Trump announced actually some new tariffs, a 25% tariff on steel, 10% on aluminum. This is what we've been waiting months to find out, and for specifically a couple weeks since the Commerce Department issued a report that right. said basically cheap imports of steel and aluminum amount to a national security threat. It was still up to Trump to decide what to do about that, and that's what he told us today. But as far as announcements go, it was pretty sparse, just some remarks from Trump. No supporting documents.
No nothing.
And so that made, yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Okay. So what do we know then about how this might shake out, when it's actually going to happen, getting to that thing about them being a pre-announcement? And you get the sense that the folks in the room were kind of surprised that this had happened. So details.
Yeah. So this was sort of an announcement about an announcement that's actually going to happen next right. week. So we know the numbers, the 25% tariff on steel, the 10% on aluminum, but we don't know a lot of details, like if this applies to all steel and aluminum products coming from all countries, or if there might be carve-outs and exceptions. Trump said the tariffs would be in place a long time, but he didn't specify how long. It seems like the tariffs might be broadly applied because they look similar to a recommendation from the Commerce Department from a couple weeks ago. But interestingly enough, after that recommendation, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis put out a public letter arguing for more targeted tariffs so that we could exempt some of our key allies who are also steel and aluminum exporters.
Right. Canada, Europe among them. And the Canadians, mm-hmm. The foreign minister said today she is not pleased. Canada is not pleased by this. So which gets us kind of to the national security argument. Walk me through how that happened and where things stand now with that.
Right. So this is a very rare argument to make. A lot of times we have these anti-dumping duties that are applied to very specific products. This is not that. This is based on a Cold War era law. The theory behind it is that if in a time of war, the U.S. had no choice but to import key defense materials from foreign producers, especially if they had to go to unfriendly countries, that would be really bad. So yeah. In limited cases, protecting your domestic industries from competition could make sense. Thing is, when I talk to people about this, they say it's a bit of a tough case to make that as applied to steel. We import about a third of our steel from and most of it from Canada.
Yeah.
It's a little easier to make that argument when it comes to aluminum because we import like 90% of it.
Yeah. We're going to get into retaliation here in a second with Scott Tong, but talk to me about the sort of the way this ripples through the economy. And we got, you know, like 20 seconds. Go.
Right. So there are clearly winners and losers here. Winners are clearly the steel and aluminum producers in the U.S. We saw their stocks rise today while the rest of the market fell. Because steel and aluminum, they go in a lot of stuff. They go in airplanes. Right. It goes in cars. It goes in construction, like high-rise buildings, pipelines, even beer cans. Those things get more expensive.
Tracy, no, not beer cans. Tracy Samuelson in New York talking about the tariffs for us. Thank you, Tracy.
No problem.
So Tracy was talking about steel and aluminum and the things that those items go into, stuff like beer cans and cars and airplanes, all of that. Here's what happens, though. Prices for those items and others could go up. Inflation is the word for that, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But not for the first time since he was inaugurated. President Trump is, with these tariffs, putting the Federal Reserve in a tough spot, introducing inflationary pressure into this economy at a time when brand new Fed Chair Powell and the gang are trying to keep things under control. All right, a phrase not yet uttered on the program today, moving on, is trade war, because one set of tariffs does not, of course, a trade war make. That said, we are in some interesting territory here. As Tracy and I were talking about, we are still waiting for specifics on these things. But at least one CEO who was in the room with the president today when he made the pre-announcement told reporters for the New York Times the president said he doesn't want to give exemptions for any country, ally or not, which raises the prospect of what those countries, allies or not, might do in response or retaliation, because tariffs go both ways, you know. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
As a signal of trade war, this is pretty loud. The tariffs are high, and they hit multiple countries. And folks like Jim Rice expect retaliation. He's former general manager of Tyson Foods in China and found himself the target of past trade fights.
Well, history will show us that for domestic political reasons and for international face reasons, the Chinese government will have to announce some kind of reaction, and they will do it tonight.
In the past, Beijing has hit back against U.S. chicken and autos. It's now eyeing sorghum, a billion-dollar grain export. Europeans tend to respond by first complaining to the World Trade Organization, but this time they may not wait. Former U.S. trade official Claire Reed says the American reason for tariffs, national security, may come across as particularly egregious.
You just don't know whether they're going to say, the heck with the WTO, this is really wrong, and we need to take action to try to protect our economies from these constraints.
In a steel tariff case before the 2004 elections, the Europeans eventually threatened to retaliate against key U.S. products. Chad Bown is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
So they put on their retaliation list products like citrus from Florida, Harley-Davidson motorcycles from Wisconsin, and other products from swing states.
The U.S. blinked and ditched the tariffs. Last summer, as this steel decision was brewing, European leaders floated a new list.
They identified bourbon from the state of Kentucky, and so think about Mitch McConnell in the Senate, and dairy products from the state of Wisconsin, so think about Paul Ryan and the House.
This time around, you can be sure updated threats are being made as we speak. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Should have mentioned, by the way, we've got that entire interview I did with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin on our website, marketplace.org. Just check it out. Kind of an interesting little session he and I had. All right, moving on. Part of the overall hubbub after the tariff news broke today came from Wall Street, which pretty quickly expressed its disapproval. Steel and aluminum makers were up. The rest of the crowd, not so much. Details, numbers, you know the drill. With Italians facing a general election on Sunday, the third biggest economy in Europe for some context, it is worth a mention that Italian voters are weighing the same issue that hobbled German Chancellor Angela Merkel in her elections last September: migration. Italy has taken in more than 600,000 migrants over the past 4 years, most of them coming from North Africa, crossing the Mediterranean in small, crowded, and often very leaky boats. Those migrants are not generally popular in Italy, and that has been reflected in this campaign. Former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has promised that if his center-right coalition does win power, it's going to deport hundreds of thousands of people. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story from Rome.
huddled inside a tent pitched on a disused bus depot on the outskirts of the city, a small group of Africans tries to recreate some of the comforts of home. Senegalese music from a battered cassette player and warmth from a small wood fire on an upturned trash can lid. There are dozens of tents here, sheltering around 150 young migrants. Among them, Johannes Skodana from Eritrea says he's relieved to have made it to Italy.
It's good for me. I'm very lucky, you know. I born again, you know.
You feel born again in Italy?
Yeah. It gives me happiness, you know.
But in a marquee on the other side of the camp, there's a reminder that he isn't entirely welcome in Italy. A charity worker gives a lesson in both the English language and human rights.
You say, I need a lawyer. And the policeman says, no, I don't give you a lawyer. And you answer, I need because it's my right.
The pushback against mass immigration into Italy is well underway, and not just from the fast-growing neo-fascist groups and their shaven-headed supporters. Resentment and fear over the influx have gone mainstream. Linda Sumoni is a teacher from Tuscany.
The immigration must be controlled.
And limited.
Yes.
Too many people are coming.
Yes, many, many, many people coming in Italy in this moment.
Immigration is a key issue in the election, and the centre-right coalition appears to be profiting most from it. Forza Italia, Silvio Berlusconi's party, has joined forces with the anti-immigrant Lega party. They seem set to win the most votes. Senator Lucio Malan of Forza Italia says the vast majority of the migrants are not refugees and people are fed up with their demands.
They ask for food, housing, TV, Wi-Fi. They don't like pasta, which is the main food for Italians.
Senator Malan, who describes himself as a moderate, says the immigrants are costing Italy $60 each a day. His coalition is pledging to repatriate 600,000 of them.
Can Italy afford to send that many back?
Of course we can. Of course we can, because we cannot afford to keep them here.
Opponents of the repatriation pledge say it could cost more than $3,500 per migrant to implement. And anyway, claims Professor of Political Science Roberto Dallamonte, it's practically impossible to deliver.
Where do you send these people without treaties, you know, without agreements with... Where do you send them? To the moon or to Mars? This is baloney. This is nonsense.
In this largely Catholic country, the centre-right coalition claims that the hundreds of thousands of mostly Muslim migrants represent a social time bomb. But their opponents say it's surely a Christian duty to welcome and absorb the incomers. Manlio De Stefano is a lawmaker with the anti-establishment Five Star Movement, the single most popular party in the country. He says the influx is manageable.
We are managing numbers like 150,000 migrants per year. In a country of 60 million people, it's feasible.
He says the centre-right should focus on the real emergency, unemployment, which has doubled since the financial crisis. But the polls suggest immigration is the bigger worry. This is the issue that is shifting the whole landscape of European politics. In Rome, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I interviewed one mother who says she loves them because you can stuff crayons and even French fries in there.
Can't ever have enough cup holders in your car, can you? Or can you? First, though, let's do the numbers. There you go. Wah-wah trombones. All I had to do was ask like 3 days in a row. Dow Industrial's off 420 points, 1.6%, closed at 24,608. NASDAQ gave back 92 points, 1.25%, 7180. The S&P 500 off 36 points, about 1.3%, 2677. Big news of the day, of course, those steel and aluminum tariffs. So here you go. Aluminum producer Alcoa up 0.2%. Steelmaker Nucor boosted 3.25%. Reliance Steel and Aluminum picked up 3.8%. However, car makers, which use a lot of steel, Ford Motor Company sputtered down 3% today. GM nearly 4%. Boeing declined 3.4%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. You know how we always say companies in this economy are looking for less regulation, a lighter government hand in how they do what they do? Yeah, well, not so fast. Next week, there's going to be a new lobbying push in Washington for more regulation of beauty products, skincare products more generally, really. It's being led by Greg Renfrew. She is the founder and CEO of Beauty Counter, which calls itself a clean beauty company, cosmetics and personal care products. She was in the other day, and I asked her why she thought her industry needed more regulations.
At Beauty Counter, we believe that there is a need for change at the federal level. We have not updated a major federal law governing this $62 billion industry since 1938. The legislation is about 1.5 pages long, and it
really for the whole
Wow. And it doesn't require the manufacturers of product to disclose all of the ingredients. So you may buy something that says all natural or botanical or pure, but it may be none of the above. And so consumers are misled by companies today.
We should be clear here that in this call for regulation that you have been doing for a while now, it would be a business advantage for you.
Not necessarily. I mean, I think
No, come on. You run a natural beauty products company and you want more regulation so that the Revlons and the Maybellines, right?
I would like to see the, you know, when I started Beauty Counter, I set out to get safer products into the hands of everyone, not to get Beauty Counter products into hands of everyone, but safer. We believe that increased regulation won't stifle innovation and that companies should not only follow our lead, but should see the opportunity in creating safer products for everyone.
Do you feel a little bit of a, what's it like for you being a CEO calling for more regulation, I guess, is the question.
People always ask me that you're asking for regulation on your industry.
Especially now in this economy today, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is that we are asking for regulation because it would actually make our jobs easier. It's difficult to navigate the waters when there is such a lack of regulation across the entire supply chain. So it's not just what we're doing as manufacturers and brands, but also what we are required to do, the links that we have to go to ensure the safety of our products from an operational standpoint as
well. So if I go to my local CVS and I look for a skincare moisturizer, whatever it is, and I want the Revlon or the Maybelline brand, it's going to cost me, I'm making this up, $5. How much is it going to cost me if I want to buy a Beauty Counter product or somebody else who is natural and all botanical?
Currently, the Beauty Counter price point is a premium price point, but it's not a luxury price point. I think there are, if you're going to a company like CVS or others, you can look to some of the leading companies like a Burt's Bees, or you can shop the market fragrance-free, knowing that our products are not always accessible to everyone. We aim to educate, first and foremost, so people can make better choices, because you can make some better choices across the entire industry.
You've gotten support on Capitol Hill, right, with personal care products regulation act that's been introduced. So in 5 years, given where we are in this economy and the way things are going in Washington with regulations and all of that, what's your guess? How are you going to be doing?
I think as a company, I think that we will continue to emerge as a leader. You look at, you know, the recent statements from companies like BlackRock and others. I think that people, you know, consumers and investors are starting to hold companies accountable for doing well and doing good simultaneously. And in terms of the regulation and the, you know, the sort of political environment in which we live, I think you are going to see further and more comprehensive legislation over cosmetics. And I think we will continue to fight the fight for, you know, the safest products on the marketplace.
It's interesting that you mentioned BlackRock. We had Larry Fink on the program a number of weeks ago talking about his letter to CEOs requiring basically social consciousness on the part of corporations in America. Do you think that has traction right now?
Since I started Beauty Counter, I started raising capital in 2011 for this company, and we launched in March of 13.
Obviously, you got capital, but how was that slog? Was it tough for you, or was it were people receptive?
Well, first of all, anyone who's raised money knows it's just always hard raising capital, no matter what. When I went out to raise money for Beauty Counter, I remember people saying to me, don't tell everyone that you want to take this to Washington. Huh. And I said, no, we're going to tell the investors that this is part of who we are. And we actually found that they were receptive. But now, having just closed another round of financing, I've seen a real shift in the venture and private equity community where they're starting to pay attention to, you know, companies that are, to your point, you know, consciously, you know, conscious, the focus on conscious capitalism.
Right. Are you profitable?
We are growing really, really rapidly and investing in our business. I'd say we're doing pretty well.
Greg Renfrew, she's the founder and CEO at Beauty Counter. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
You want to know more about federal regulations? I know you do. Check out season two of our podcast, The Uncertain Hour. I saw a headline in the Wall Street Journal the other day, the answer to which, if you ask me, is, you bet. Is it possible, the headline asked, to have too many cup holders? Car makers are apparently in pursuit of the answer, as frankly am I. So we called up Chester Dawson. He's a reporter in the Journal's Detroit Bureau. And I started with whether it was always the case that cup holders were so plentiful.
No, it wasn't. They're a fairly recent innovation. Going back decades, the interior side of the glove compartment has, you know, often been used as a place to store a couple of drinks, but primarily when the car was stationary. And it really wasn't until the early to mid 80s that you started to see your traditional kind of well-shaped holder for cups. Back then, they were much more shallow than they tend to be today. And, you know, by the 90s, they became fairly standard, but mostly for U.S. vehicles. And their global entree has been a much more recent development.
Well, there's a great anecdote in the piece of how Mercedes-Benz has tried and really failed to get Americans to drink their coffee at home and not have to deal with cup holders at all.
There is a sense among particularly performance-oriented companies and drivers that you really shouldn't be eating a donut in one hand and drinking a cup of coffee in the other while you're on the road, that should be saved for before or after you get out of the vehicle.
And there is some merit to that. So I'm trying to think of my minivan, and granted that's supposed to hold 7 or 8 people. I've got 12, I think, cup holders, which can't all conceivably possibly ever be used to hold cups and bottles, right? We put more stuff in there, Americans do.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, oftentimes they're just used to store and empty, but, you know, they're quite typically used to hold spare change. I interviewed one mother who says she loves them because you can stuff crayons and even French fries in there. So it's a nice, handy place. Problem is oftentimes cleaning them. They're not necessarily the cleanest places in the world, and getting down in there to clean up all the goop is a frustration that I heard many parents tell me about.
And I will echo that one myself, just to throw a little personal bias in here. Talk to me for a second about self-driving cars and what that will mean for cup holders, because I hadn't really thought this one through.
You know, the point about self-driving is that it frees you up to do many more things in a car while you're commuting or taking a cross-country trip. I was at a conference earlier this year about futuristic vehicle interiors, and there was a GM technician who said that one thing they're looking into now is self-cleaning cup holders, believe it or not.
Oh, really? Oh, that'd be amazing.
And that's more for the rideshare vehicle that you hear a lot about, you know, the taxis of the future. You know, obviously, if it's your own family, it's one thing. If it's a stranger who spills their Big Gulp or Slurpee, you're going to want that cleaned up before the next passenger gets in.
Are these cup holders, are they selling points for automakers?
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of a quiet selling point. Volkswagen debuted its new Atlas SUV last year and was quite proud of the fact that it had 17 cup holders. Only to be outdone a few months later by Subaru with 19, which is, the current record, but perhaps not for too much longer.
That's just an invitation to get the inside of your car all dirtied up.
It is kind of amazing. It was explained to me that, you know, we're in an era where you may have a drink box, a sports drink, a cup of coffee. Stuff's got to go somewhere.
I guess it does. Chester Dawson writes on Detroit and cars and cup holders, apparently, for the Wall Street Journal. Chester, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which the Pew Research Center, as good an arbiter as any really, lays down the law on who is a millennial and who is not. After all, Pew says they've been studying that cohort for more than a decade now, so here's the deal. Pew Research Center is going to use 1996 as the last birth year for millennials. Anybody born between 1981 and 1996, that is 22 to 37 this year if you're counting on your fingers, you're in. 1997 and on, you're out, left undecided. And please do weigh in with us on Twitter on this one. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. The show is at Marketplace. Left undecided is what post-millennials ought to be called. What do you think? Okay, that's all we got. The Dow Jones Industrial Average off 420 points today, 1.6%. NASDAQ gave back 92 points, about 1.25%. The S&P 500 off 36, that is 1.33%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.